This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on any topic, including John McCain. This is the headline, the New York Times today. McCain supports Bush's warrantless wiretaps. John McCain has flipped his position on warrantless wiretaps to look very similar to George Bush's. That from Huffington Post. Top advisor to Senator McCain says Mr. McCain believes that President Bush's program of wiretapping without warrants was lawful, a position that appears to bring him into close alignment with the sweeping theories of executive authority pushed by the Bush administration legal team. Anyhow, we'll get into that as the program goes on. As always on Friday, the first hour of our show, Senator Bernie Sanders, neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but an independent, the independent from Vermont. I think of Bernie as America's senator. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The oil price hit a record high today at the same time that we're seeing record levels of tornadoes across the American Midwest, and record heat is going to hit New York City tomorrow. It's all pretty – it's like a perfect storm.
Well, all of these things, as you indicate, tie together, and it's actually – these are the issues that are on the floor of the Senate right now. Unfortunately, as is often the case, there is not – real debate, not real voting on these issues, because the Republicans keep putting up their filibusters. But let me tell you what we're trying to do. I have to say that from my own state of Vermont, we have received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails from people who really don't know what is going to happen next winter when heating oil prices go completely off the wall. We heat a lot with oil, and workers who are now paying $4 for a gallon of gas are finding it harder to fill up their gas tanks just to get to work and back from work because they travel long distances. So the issue of how you deal with our friends at ExxonMobil, who in the last 2 years have earned more profits than any corporation in the history of the world, companies like Occidental, which last year paid their CEO, a guy named Ray Irani, some $400 million in total compensation. How you deal with that is something that has to be addressed, and hopefully that will be coming to the floor early next week. And the other part is not just the oil companies and their greed. We're used to that. But there's a lot of evidence out there now that speculation on the part of companies like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and other hedge funds are also driving up the price of oil. There was a very interesting hearing in the Senate Commerce Committee earlier in the week with George Soros, among others, talking about speculation. And there are some economists, at least, who believe that maybe one-third of the cost of a barrel of oil today has nothing to do with supply and demand, nothing to do with the cost of production, but simply with the kind of speculation that is going on.
Yeah.
And that's an issue that has got to be dealt with. We're
worried. Concerned that that's the case now with food as well.
That's right. And we're worried especially with that likelihood of speculation impacting home heating oil prices for New England. But certainly it is a national issue in terms of high oil prices. So this is an issue that must be dealt with. We've got to re-regulate a lot of these exchanges that have been deregulated. There's a lot of stuff that's going on that the American people are just not aware of. That's one issue. And as you indicate, tied into that issue, interestingly enough, is the issue of global warming. Just this morning, a few hours ago here in the Senate, by a vote of 48-36, senators voted to go forward on a global warming bill, but we didn't get the 60 votes that we needed to end debate. So for this year, as far as I can understand, the debate over global warming is over. Republicans have been successful once again in filibustering. Now, this bill, frankly, was not as strong as I wanted it to see. It was not as good as I wanted it to be. But if we had gone forward, we would have had the opportunity to bring forth some amendments to make it into a serious bill. The issue of global warming, according to virtually the entire scientific community, including people who received the Nobel Peace Prize for their work, is not only real, it is enormously serious, and we have got to get a handle on it, or we're going to be looking at severe increased numbers of severe weather disturbances. You're going to look at drought. You're going to look at the loss of arable land, which means increased hunger around the world. You're going to look at increased strife among countries fighting for limited resources, increased disease. We don't have an option, despite what some of our Republican friends may think. We've got to get a handle on this. Now, the good news, and I believe this very strongly, is that we have the knowledge and the technology today, not 10 years from now, to address this issue. I don't happen to believe it's quite as complicated as some people make it out to be. I can tell you that in the state of Vermont, for example, and we have a long way to go, we're beginning to make some real progress on energy efficiency. And I can tell you that there's a lot of technology out there in terms of solar, in terms of wind, in terms of hybrid plug-in cars that can go 150 miles per gallon, in terms of the need to rebuild our rail system so that we can have the kind of mass transportation that Europe and Japan have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that we do this, we can move away not only from foreign oil, but from fossil fuels in general, move to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And, Tom, in that process, you can create millions of good-paying jobs.
Yeah, particularly if we can figure out a way to keep the manufacturing end of it here at home.
Exactly. If we are building,
which has to do with our crazy trade deals.
That's exactly right. If we're building photovoltaics here, if we're doing weatherization here, if we're building cars that are, instead of seeing Detroit shut down plants and lower the wages of workers, if we're building the kinds of cars that the American people want and need, think about what a new rail system would mean in terms of job creation. In the state of Vermont, we have a landfill, which is now, we're now producing methane gas from that landfill, generating electricity for 5,000 homes. We can be doing this all over America. So I am not unoptimistic about us beginning to cope with this issue, but we need some leadership, and we need some good thinking to go forward.
Yeah, and a necessary one. At the same time, some would argue that the search for the resource oil that is causing, in large part, the problem of global warming is what led us right into Iraq, and this
that's
leads
right.
to the mess with our veterans.
No,
right
that's exactly right, and that takes us to the whole issue of the need for energy independence. We can do these things. You know, we don't have to be in Iraq fighting for oil. When we can be producing enormous amounts of solar energy and wind energy. To me, this is not a complicated issue. There are, as I've mentioned on this show before, right now there are plans to be building what we call solar thermal plants in Southern California. In Nevada, there's one that's already up. Each one of these plants can produce as much electricity as a small nuclear power plant. And there is a belief that we can build dozens of them in the Southwest. Mm. Produce 15 to 20% of the electricity America needs. On top of that,
yep.
we can have 10 million rooftops with photovoltaics. So the potential is just enormous. But this country, unfortunately, especially under Bush's disastrous leadership, is so far behind that it's really quite sad.
Yeah, yeah. And in the meantime, our veterans are being left behind in the dust.
Well, we had a meeting just this week on veterans issues, and the concern there is, once again, the VA is not addressing what we call the invisible wounds. So many of these soldiers are now coming home with PTSD, traumatic brain injuries. The suicide rates are quite high, attempted suicides. And clearly, no matter what one's view is on this disastrous war, and I obviously have opposed it and voted against it, we have a moral obligation to take care of our veterans.
Yeah, and which leads to defense. Broadly speaking, is our country safer? Are we getting our money's worth for $500 billion?
There is finally, I am happy to tell you, the beginning of some discussion on defense. We are spending half of our discretionary budget, $515 billion, on defense.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, I think it's indisputable. I mean, there's no debate. But that there's enormous amount of waste. There's fraud that's going on. There's duplicative weapon systems that are out there. Is $515 billion being spent on fighting international terrorism? Of course it's not. is a lot of that money still being used to fight the old Cold War with the Soviet Union? Yes, it is. Have we had the kind of discussion that we need to sort this out? No, we haven't.
Yeah, not even close. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Our toll-free number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi, AirAmerica.com, and, of course, Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's website. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
The hour, the Tom Hartmann radio program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls. And Dave in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. You're live with Senator Sanders.
Thanks for having me on. I just want to say thank you. A question is about cap and trade and what your take on that, Senator Sanders, is, particularly given that the EPA estimates it will increase the price of gas by about $1.50 a gallon.
No, I don't accept that, and I think that that's wrong. That's a wrong estimate. I think that if we are aggressive in producing the kinds of cars that can get 100 or 150 miles per gallon, I think if we are aggressive in moving toward energy efficiency, toward solar, toward wind, that is a preposterous estimate. I've not heard that estimate before. I know the Republicans are coming up and saying it's going to raise gas prices, but there are countervailing arguments that it, in fact, is not going to do that. The second point to be made is, frankly, I don't know that you have a choice in terms of addressing the crisis of global warming. Cap and trade is an important approach. Right now, what you're having is major polluters, people putting huge amounts of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, which are clearly causing global warming, which are wreaking havoc and will only increase that havoc in years to come. And the issue is not just what it will cost us to address the problem. I think we have to ask what it will cost us if we do not address the crisis. In terms of Hurricane Katrina's, in terms of the increased price of food because we're losing arable land, and in terms of California and the West Coast now beginning to think very hard about water supplies in years to come in terms of increased disease. So this is an issue that has to be dealt with. I think, as is often the case, people who do not want to deal with it are raising these telling us how terrible and awful everything will be. I don't accept that.
Bernie, if I may just follow on to that, most European countries are paying the actual cost of gas when you consider the cost of defending the oil pipelines and the infrastructure and the military and frankly the fact that the oil companies only pay 12.5% royalty on the oil that they pump out of our land, out of land owned by we the people. There have been suggestions that if we put in a carbon tax like Sweden did of I think there's $300 a ton, and then reduced income taxes, that while the price of gas would go up, people would get a check back in the mail.
Right.
You know, there's ways to do this.
There are ways. That's exactly right. And in this particular bill, there was huge. This was a bill that was projecting out to close to 40 years. So there was a huge amount of money precisely to protect lower and moderate income people who might see increases in their cost of energy. So there are ways to deal with that. But I think you're going to be hearing from the doomsayers about how just we can't do it, we can't do it, we can't do it. And what I'm saying is every day that we don't go forward aggressively is going to cost us more. There are estimates that if we do not deal with global warming, you're going to see severe economic downturns throughout the entire world. You're having reports coming from our own intelligence agencies who talk about the danger of increased strife and warfare as countries fight over limited resources. So I don't think we have a choice, but I do not accept the doomsday guys who talk about all of these terrible things. I think if we're aggressive on energy efficiency, if we're aggressive in moving to sustainable energy, let me give you one example. It is quite likely that if we invest heavily in these thermal solar plants in the Southwest, that within a short period of time, that is not only going to be a competitive in terms of price source of energy, it will be lower cost than other sources of energy.
Okay. It's better than drilling in Anwar.
Yeah.
Yep. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Florida, the Sunshine State, doesn't have a lot of solar down here.
You're right. And that is one of the areas. I think the general feeling is the Southwest is optimum, but Florida has tremendous potential as well.
Mr. Sanders, I just turned on CBS News, and they said the Iraqi people are protesting. They're pouring out of their mosques because of the security deal that Bush wants to do with permanent troops there permanently. And they're protesting. They don't want that kind of interference in their government. And also, there were 49,000 jobs lost in May. I think these are two huge issues that
right.
we have to deal with.
That's right.
Thank you, Flo.
Well, you've touched on two issues, and obviously they're related. The war goes on and on and on. McCain wants to continue this war going on and on and on. More people in our country, our soldiers are getting killed and wounded. And let us never forget, and sometimes we don't pay enough attention to this, this war is costing us $12 billion, that's with a B, $12 billion every single month that Bush is not paying for, but he's asking our kids and grandchildren to pay for by increasing the national debt. This war has got to end.
Right.
We've got to bring the troops home.
And now he's trying to cut a back alley deal with the Iraqi government to keep us there, even if Obama wants to pull us out. I mean, it's crazy. 27 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie. Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's website and his newsletter. Our website, TomHartmann.com, and, of course, AirAmerica.com. 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. We certainly know who Senator Bernie Sanders is, one of the most progressive members of the U.S. Senate, the independent senator from Vermont, Sanders.Senate.gov, and he is with us this hour. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartmann Program. And Alan in Portland, Oregon, listening on 620 KPOJ. You're on with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. I have a question and a thought for the senator.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Senator Sanders, 30 years ago, I was involved with a nonprofit in Ashland, Oregon, and this nonprofit went around to build passive solar attached sun spaces to private residences, because at that time President Carter had tax credits for such construction work. It's you're talking about active, you know, this photovoltaics, the active side of solar. But you must please look into the passive side of solar, because if we can look at that, you would put so many more people to work on the construction side putting these things on. If you could, sir, get one somebody on your staff to look up President Carter's old tax credits.
Yep.
And because next year, once the Democratic Party regains control of both sides of the House, these kind of thing should be worked in as a complete mix, because passive solar works nationwide.
No, you're absolutely right, Alan. No argument there. And we want to make it easier with tax credits and other incentives for people to do that type of construction.
Yes, and because as soon as Reagan took office, those tax credits disappeared overnight.
You got it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Let's see here. Kelly in Redlands, California.
Good morning, Tom. I love your program, Bernie. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen to us out here trying to make ends meet. Hey, I have a question for you. I wanted to know why I need to have a street address to get a post office box.
You mean a homeless person or a transient can't get a post office box?
I'm sorry, what was that?
A homeless person or a transient can't get a post office box?
Not unless you have a street address. I'm currently unemployed and quote-unquote homeless. I'm living in my small little RV because it's cheaper than renting until I get another job. And I needed to get a new post office box, and I went to the post office. They would not give me one unless I had a street address. I basically had to lie and use a property that I have in Wisconsin, which is a rental property. It's not my home. I don't live there. I live in California.
All right, Kelly, that's a good question. I don't know the answer, but it's something that we could take a look into.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for raising that. I wonder if the Patriot Act is a remnant of one of those things.
I don't know, but it does speak to, I mean, here we have an example of somebody who's living in their car.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
You know, and that speaks to just the terrible economic problems that working families are facing today, not just in housing, not even just in gas and oil prices, but in healthcare and education. And the fundamental question that we have got to ask ourselves is why, in the year 2008, with so much new technology out there, so much worker productivity going on, why is the middle class shrinking and poverty increasing? And
30 years of Reaganomics and the war on the middle class.
And you know, Tom, I'm here in Washington right now, and if you walk down the corridors, the media will talk to you about Hillary and Obama and all this stuff, and that's fine. But we got to start focusing on the real problems facing the American people and make sure that those are the issues that are talked about in this campaign. And if that is the case, we're going to win this election and win it big. And if we get into personality and we get into political gossip, well, you can have a President McCain.
Yeah, I agree. Judy in Scottsdale, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Gentlemen, just a great honor to speak to both of you. I have great respect for you. This seemed to be the best platform, I guess, for me to ask my question. I am... one of the rarest of all creatures, I guess. I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I'm also a gun-toting liberal.
Hey, I'm an NRA member.
Well, so am I. So, Tom, I guess that's why I wanted to go this direction. I will vote Democratic regardless, particularly given all of the issues that we have this year. But people like my husband and friends of his are kind of caught up in the hysteria that if the Dems take power, that we'll be looking at highly restrictive gun laws coming back. And wondering what...
Okay, Judy, let me answer that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Look, here's the simple reality. We have right now under President Bush the worst president in the modern history of America, and it really gives me no pleasure to say that, whether it is the economy, whether it's health care, whether it's the environment, whether it's certainly Iraq and foreign policy, he has led us big time in the wrong direction. In terms of public policy, what McCain will be doing for the next many, many months until Election Day is trying to tell the American people how very different he is from George W. Bush on many issues. The truth is, that ain't the case. And what, Judy, your husband is going to have to decide is whether or not he wants to continue this right-wing extremist policies, which have caused so many problems for the middle class and working families of our country, which has caused so many international problems in terms of a very, very disastrous foreign policy. And what clearly the Republicans will be doing is trying to find wedge issues. And I am sure that there will be literature going out to gun owners all over America that if the Democrats take the power, if Obama is elected, every gun in America is going to be taken away, and all this other nonsense. And that's what it is. It is nonsense. All right. That is not going to happen. And you'll see people just trying to frighten people. They'll be frightening people on the issue of gay marriage. They'll be frightening people on the issue of abortion. And all of that effort is an attempt to deflect attention from the most important issues facing the American people, and that is, why is the middle class collapsing? Why is the gap between the very rich and everybody else getting wider? Why are we not the only country? Why are we the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care program? Why are we not creating jobs by addressing global warming? On and on and on it goes. So that effort is going to take place. They're going to take away every gun in America. It's just not true. It's a scare tactic. They've done it year after year, and it's just not true. And we've got to get the word out about that.
Yeah, and there's a broad diversity of views on the so-called left on that. I think you have almost 100% positive voting record with the NRA.
Well, no, I don't. But I believe in sensible, unlimited gun control, and I voted against the Brady Bill. I voted for a ban on certain types of semi-automatics. But I think the people who will be pushing this issue are people who really simply want to maintain the status quo and use the gun issue as a method to frighten a whole lot of people.
Just another wedge issue. Len in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon. I'm one of those speculators in oil and or gold. And, we're going to try and put blame. The real blame is the deficits that we've been running, both personally, with each individual borrowing more than he has, and the government. In February, I heard a report soon after February ended that the government, because tax revenues were lower, took in $170 billion less than it spent just in the 1 month of February. So this money is going looking for a home, and that's what's pushing inflation up. And, in terms of trying to stop this oil price rise, my recommendation would be to institute a bill that increases the margin on the contract up to, weekly, daily, up until you get to 65%. Because right now I can go buy $130,000 worth of oil, putting down about $8,000.
Right. Okay, Len makes, I think the last point that Len makes is a very good point. And that is, we have an amendment just not up to 65%. I think we're talking about 50%. But right now, Len's point is, you can buy a hell of a lot of oil, on margin with a very small amount of money. We gotta raise that margin very substantially. That is exactly right. Len also points out that we have a huge national debt. I think his point was that the dollar is declining, and that's certainly one of the reasons, and that is also correct. But speculation is a major issue, and we have to address speculation. One part of the speculation issue is the margin issue, and that is something that we intend to be dealing with.
Is this something that – is that part of it something that has changed recently? I know that Bernie – and we have just a half a minute here before a break. I know that there have been changes in, like what banks can do and brokerage houses can do and things like that. But have margins ever been regulated?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer, but I know that Len is absolutely right. For a few bucks now, you can buy, speculate on margin big time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, puts and calls have been around forever in the stock market, but that's the stock market.
Right.
But even there was, the Glass-Steagall Act. Well, actually, I guess that was banks, wasn't it? But there's always been some regulation until Phil Graham got a hold of a lot of this stuff.
That's right.
John McCain's chief financial advisor.
Who pushed through this Enron loophole.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.Senate.gov, TomHartman.com, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
night, one paycheck away from turn out the lights. If the kids don't get sick, we just might survive. Sometimes the good fight is hard. See, I'm American too. I'm out on the street and I sleep in the park. Since my hopes melted down into this shopping cart, my world's a place where living's an art. But I could still come back. See, I'm American.
Yep, we're all America too here. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman radio program. Stacy in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Stacy, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Good morning. Senator Sanders, I have a question for you. After Senator Rockefeller announced the findings of the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday that the president lied to get us into the war, which only confirms what we all knew to be true, I want to know what is going to be done. It's not acceptable for me to hear, well, he's going to be leaving office soon. We have to do something.
Well, Stacey, it may not be acceptable to you, and it may not be acceptable to me, and it may not be acceptable to most Americans, but right now it is impossible to get anything passed in the United States Senate because we need 60 votes to even stop debate, and we can't do that. So I share your outrage, but that we didn't get 60 votes to end debate on global warming. We have very hard to get 60 votes almost on anything. And I have to tell you, you may not be happy to hear this, but this comes down to what kind of people we have in the Senate, what kind of people we have in the House, and most importantly, who we have in the White House. Now, what this report tells us, as you indicate, is what we already know, that to a significant degree, we were misled into this terrible war by one of the worst presidents in the history of this country. And that is why this election is so terribly, terribly important, because we have to move this country under a new president in a very, very different direction. And you and I can be outraged about what happened yesterday or what happened years ago. But right now, our energy has got to go into electing a new president. We've got to elect Barack Obama. We got to elect progressives to the House and the Senate. And then the day after the election, we have to continue to mobilize people to make sure that the new president and the new Congress move this country in a progressive direction, have the courage to stand up to some very, very powerful special interests who are going to do everything they can to prevent progress.
Woody in Litchfield, Arizona. Woody, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've got a proposal for the subprime mess to give relief to individuals. And this comes from my experience as a farmer's home county supervisor in the High Plains during the 80s. When New Century, which was the number two mortgage company, went bankrupt, they sold $170 million worth of mortgages for $58 million. That's less than 35 cents on the dollar. If we could open that market up to the individual and say, hey, if somebody's buying your mortgage and you pay a nickel more, then the borrower gets the relief, the investor gets more money, and the bank that makes that guy the new loan to buy out the old one has a more solid loan.
Well, Woody, it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it seems
let me, and I got to tell you, I think that this issue is going to be up here next week. Or the week after. So let me think about that. That is an interesting idea.
I think my guess would be that the downside of that, or the argument from the bank's point of view on the downside of that, would be that this would then become a mechanism that people can use to basically flip their own mortgages.
No, that's...
And, you know, that, well, I don't know. It would kill your credit, though. So you'd have a strong disincentive to do it, I would think. But
Well, we're going to need some ideas. Yeah. I mean, this foreclosure crisis is terribly serious, so we're going to have to reach out and help those people who are losing their homes.
Yeah. Bill in Wilmington, Delaware, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator. I'm a huge fan of yours. I've seen a lot of reports lately that there are Chinese oil rigs with 1960s technology drilling 60 miles off the coast of Florida. Given being that that's the case, wouldn't it make more sense that we recover that oil with our clean technology rather than a communist country with 1960s technology as far as environmental concerns go?
Bill, that's the answer is yes, and I have not heard that, which does not make it true, but I am not aware of that.
Okay. Chris in Highland Lakes, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Senator. I wish all our elected representatives did this. I have a quick question about oil and a comment about solar power. I'm a union electrician. My question about oil, the price of gold has gone up 3 to 4 times in the last 8 years, and so has oil. So isn't the biggest reason for the price of oil a devaluation of the dollar? Because if our dollar was still backed by gold, oil would basically still be stable, no?
Well, no, but the valuation of the dollar is one of the factors, Chris. But I think speculation is certainly, according to a number of economists, a very important factor. And the old-fashioned greed of the oil companies is an issue. Supply and demand, there's more oil being going to China and to India, and that's a factor as well.
Okay, and about solar power, I definitely think we need to move towards alternative energies, no doubt. Now, I hear a lot of talk about solar plants and solar thermal plants being opened.
Yeah.
I also think we really need to move towards self-sustainability, which if we're opening plants, then we're still kind of going to be not owned by the energy companies, but they're going to have a big control over us as opposed to having solar panels and producing individual electricity.
Good point. Good point. I don't think, Chris, I don't think it's either or. I think these thermal plants are capable of producing an enormous amount of electricity. And you're right, they will be owned by the electric companies. On the other hand, what Germany is doing and what California is doing to some degree is incentivizing homeowners and businesses to put photovoltaics up on their own rooftops, which I strongly support. There's a concept called a feed-in tariff, which decentralizes electricity production because you get paid. You're like a small business that is producing electricity, and you get paid for putting electricity into the grid. So I don't think it's either or. I think we should move forward vigorously in both ways.
Yeah, and your point of Germany is amazing. You take the train across the German countryside these days, and you look north at the south side of all the roofs, and you will see solar panels on not every single roof, but just it's huge. I mean, they have not built 2 nuclear power plants in the last 6 years as a result of that.
Right.
Senator Bernie Sanders with the Sanders.Senate.gov, Bernie's website. TomHartmann.com, ours. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. The lines are slammed. We'll be right back to your calls right after. Oh, no, we're not. It's the end of the hour. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, Tom.
I am totally confused. Thanks, Bernie. We'll be back.
Tom Hartmann.
Hoping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Somewhat disoriented, I guess, given how we wrapped up our last hour. Yesterday, I was broadcasting live from the United Nations and had my laptop on the Wi-Fi network there, and apparently somebody got into it because it's deader than a doornail today. So I am... running with half the information I normally have right now, and it's an interesting day, Dan Hines is with us. I wanted to get there has been so little, frankly, press coverage about Barack Obama's legislative efforts and accomplishments in Illinois. His background, people he himself has described himself as a Rorschach test, and I think that people see in him what they want to see in him, whether they're projecting their hopes or their fears. And it's, I think, high time now that he's a Democratic nominee or the presumptive Democratic nominee that we start actually knowing who this guy is, where he came from, what he's all about. Dan Hines, friendsofdan.com is his website, is the Illinois State Comptroller. He's a three-term Illinois State Comptroller, and he ran against Barack Obama in the Senate primary, and then when Barack Obama won that, he became one of the first voices calling on him to run in 2007. Dan, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, and thanks for dropping by. Tell us, who is Barack Obama? What for those of us who don't live in Illinois, what do you all know about him that we don't?
Well, I should tell you that he's obviously a phenomenon. He's got a man of enormous talent, but he's also a guy who you would like to have a beer with, like to hang out with, like to shoot hoops with, because as talented as he is, he doesn't really make you feel like you're inferior or make you feel like, you know, he's just so far beyond you. And I think there are a lot of us in Illinois, even though we knew, you know, he had the ability to put a campaign like this together and the ability to make it to the big stage, a lot of us are a little bit in disbelief right now just because we knew him as this guy we used to hang around with in Springfield and was just like everybody else, except extremely intelligent, extremely talented, with unbelievable promise.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think we all have that sense of him. But, you know, what did he do? What were his legislative accomplishments? What, you know, when people call and they say, you know, well, okay, you know, what kind of president is he going to be? What has he done?
Well, he has an impressive legislative list of accomplishments that I can rattle off. But let me first give you some context for it. When he was elected to the Senate, the state Senate.
Uh-huh.
The Republicans controlled that chamber and most of state government. And so it was very difficult for everybody to get things done on the Democratic side because, you know, the parliamentary procedures are even more hostile than they are in Washington where, you know, the majority party pretty much controls the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, even in that, in that context and in that climate, Barack was able to get some pretty significant stuff done when he was in the minority party, and later on he was in the majority party. Passing some ethics legislation was important. Just like he did when he went to Washington, he wasn't afraid to take on tough issues and also issues that really got into the kitchen of legislators and politicians. I mean, Illinois has probably the most freewheeling campaign finance laws in the country. We have no limits. We have no restrictions on contributions. And at that time, we had no limits on or restrictions on how you use your campaign money. People could convert it to personal use very easily. And he went right after that and worked with Senator Paul Simon on passing some sweeping reforms. And they've made Illinois better in a lot of ways. But more importantly, I think it spoke to the fact that he wasn't afraid to take on even his colleagues, even his own party, to do these types of things. And when it was all done, people didn't view him as, some troublemaker, bomb thrower. He really had great relationships even coming out of it because he just has this ability to make things happen, to get people to understand where he's coming from and to make progress, even if they don't agree with him from the outset. And I think that's part of what he'll bring to Washington.
I agree, and I think that's a lot of that is the stuff that we're all seeing. When you say John McCain, people immediately go, ah, yeah, well, war hero, prisoner of war, McCain-Feingold, campaign finance reform, McCain this, McCain, you know, his name is on several pieces of legislation, McCain-Kennedy, et cetera, specific legislative accomplishments. I think that part of Barack Obama's bio needs to be part of the zeitgeist, needs to be, we need to get that out there. So you said you could rattle off a list of legislative accomplishments. Rattle off.
Okay. Well, he was also involved in passing some welfare reform legislation in Illinois. He was involved in death penalty reforms. He was instrumental in passing what we call Kid Care program in Illinois, which is the children's health insurance program of the federal level. Very involved with me as the controller in budget reforms. Again, not a popular thing with Democrats when you are trying to impose spending limits, you're trying to impose, you know, fiscally responsible measures to keep Illinois on the right track financially. We worked closely on those things. He worked on a racial profiling bill. These are one of those things that are very sensitive in nature, where you have law enforcement who has very, very strong feelings about it, and you have, advocates, on the other side that feel that reforms must take place. And he was able to, you know, bring people together and work on these very sensitive issues and bring about results. These are the things that I think give you a glimpse of not only what his priorities are, but his, you know, conviction and ability to step into issues that may not make him popular for the moment, but he knows needs to be done. And again, in Washington, where we've avoided a lot of the tough issues, whether it's Social Security reform, health care, you know, budget restraint, all these things, you know, I think he's going to be in a good position to bring people together.
We're talking with Dan Hynes. He's the comptroller for the state of Illinois, third term, and ran against Barack Obama in the Senate primary, and was one of the very first to endorse him. Dan, you mentioned death penalty reform. This was in collaboration with a Republican governor, was it not, after it was discovered that a number of innocent people had been put to death in Illinois?
Right, and I think that, you know, there was a real growing call for this type of reform that were there were a lot of individual cases that were showing some of the abuses that had taken place. And even though there was this growing desire, it still was something that was not easy to put together because, you know, there were people on the other side that just, you know, didn't want to have any reform whatsoever.
It got, you guys are soft on crime, they're saying, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the type of, you know, polarization that he was in the middle of.
Right. Any sense, I've had several calls over the last couple of days, people wondering what Barack Obama's position is or historically has been, or if you know, going forward, will be, with regard to the Second Amendment and gun control.
Well, I mean, you know, generally, you know, when Barack ran for the United States Senate, he had a lot of support in parts outside of his district, you know, where he was, I think, educated on some of these issues. And you know, I think coming from the city of Chicago and from the inner city where gun violence is a real problem even today, he was able to strike that balance between respecting gun owners and hunters, but at the same time making sure that we have sensible gun laws to keep our kids safe, to keep our streets safe. And I'd say, you know, as a broad matter, you know, that's what he's been able to, you know, strike that balance.
Yeah, okay. And with regard to welfare reform, you talked of, you know, or welfare, I mean, Bill Clinton called it welfare reform, and it was a fancy way of saying throwing people off the welfare rolls, ultimately. There's some evidence that Clinton's reforms actually increased poverty in the United States, contrary, you know, in contrast to how Johnson, the LBJ's war on poverty, cut poverty in the United States by almost half eventually over 4 years. What in the minute we have left here, what was Barack Obama's position on welfare? What was he doing in Illinois?
Well, I mean, he sponsored Illinois' version of welfare reform, which, you know, required work requirements, had time limits, but at the same time, you know, gave people the opportunity to get the training they needed to make a decent wage, because he also sponsored the earned income tax credit, or expansion of the earned income tax credit in Illinois. So once again, you know, a balance, making sure that, you know, people had to work if they were able to work, but giving them the tools they needed and the rewards that would allow them to provide for their family and become successful. And, you know, again, I think that's the hallmark of his governing style and certainly of his past.
Yeah, he's a consensus builder and a leader, it sounds like.
Consensus builder is right.
Yeah. Friendsofdan.com, Dan Hynes' website, if you want to check it out. Dan, the Illinois State Comptroller. Dan, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
I much, much appreciate the insight of a fellow resident of Illinois and participant in the politics of that state. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, the No Boring Zone.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes. Friday, 21 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And we're, by the way, broadcasting live from New York City today. And Ron in Aspen, Colorado. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Hi. I was calling first about the senator was on, and one thing I wanted to mention was Judith Craven's book about nuclear power, where she researched this book for 8 years, thinking that nuclear power was the worst thing, and her, as a staunch liberal, and her result was that, the result of her book was that France basically has it right, and safe nuclear power is the answer.
Yeah, so, Ron, I had her on this program. I've read the book.
Oh, okay.
And she got it wrong.
Okay.
And in fact, she was unable to answer even a simple question of, if nuclear power is so great, why will no insurance company insure it in the United States? Why do we have to have the Price-Anderson Act, A? And B, she couldn't answer, what are the French going to do with the nuclear waste that they're glassifying and embalming all over the country in 800 years when the glass disintegrates, because that nuclear waste has a half-life of 250,000 years? She had no answers for those questions. During the 8 years that she was writing the book, I don't want to characterize her personally. I'll stick with the topics.
I wanted to hear some feedback on the other side of it.
Yeah, her book is, in my opinion, she's not a scientist, has no background as one. She's a writer, and I think she was either wittingly or unwittingly completely taken in by a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Right. Now, I have one other question. You're a guy that you just had on for the last 15 minutes.
Hmm.
I was a big Edwards and a big Hillary fan, more Edwards than Hillary, even Joe Biden. And one of the reasons is because I feel strongly that I like to hear solutions and I like to hear substance. The fellow was just on that you asked direct questions of. He basically didn't give you a direct answer.
Well, he ultimately did. And I asked for the specific details, and he had them. I'm not sure that Dan. We've been looking around for somebody who could speak on behalf of Barack Obama. We're going to get some official people from the campaign who've been prepped and really been through it. This was a guy that we were able to grab kind of quickly. Sean put this together in about 4 hours, I think. Dan, I thought Dan comported himself well, but I agree with you. I would like to hear more details, and we're going to have to hear a lot more details. The American people are going to demand a lot more details, Ron, about Barack Obama's legislative past and his accomplishments.
Let me tell you, my hardest part for me is that I've seen John McCain here a bunch of times in Aspen, listened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Just the judge thing with John McCain makes it so there's no way I can vote for him.
You mean
and
the Supreme
so,
Court?
No matter how much I don't like Obama, I can't vote for McCain because of that,
yeah.
And that's just a fact. And so even though Obama scares me to death with the lack of substance.
Yeah, well, I think, again, we are all, to a certain extent, and I've probably been doing it more on the plus side, and you've probably been doing it more on the minus side, we are all projecting on Barack Obama our greatest hopes and our worst fears. In other words, he is that Rorschach test, and he will be until he clearly defines himself. And I know that there's a lot of information on his website about him and his background, BarackObama.com, just an enormous amount of information on his past and on his biography and on his positions on the issues and things like that. But that said, frankly, Ron, I have to say I fault more than the campaign. Although I'd like to see the campaign doing more of this, and I'd like to see them getting, their surrogates out there doing a better job of talking about the substance of his past. Frankly, I fault the media. MSNBC, I'm here in New York, and it was, two nights ago, I think, and either 11 o'clock or midnight. I got back to Jerry's apartment late and wasn't asleep yet, and I had MSNBC on, and they did, as I recall, a one-hour documentary on the life of Barack Obama. And it was really well done. And it covered a lot of the detail of his life, and it gave me, I thought, a pretty good sense of him. And I thought, this is great. This, congratulations to MSNBC. But here it was showing in the middle of the night. And the news networks, I think, the biggest story in America right now is that a guy that nobody even knew who he was 3 years ago, whose main claim to fame in the popular, in the broad American mainstream of, who's out there and who isn't, was that he had given this big speech at the DNC 4 years ago. That was about it. I mean, that was his coming out of the American stage. This guy that nobody even knew who he was 2 years ago is now going to be the nominee for president of the Democratic Party and may well be our next president. That's a huge story. And so why are the corporate media in America ignoring who is this guy? What are his positions on the issues? What has he done in the past? Where has he come from? How did he grow up? There have been these soft brushes, but in most of it, frankly, has been campaign commercials because we had a 54, you know, altogether with American Samoa and everything else. But, you know, we had, you know, a full primary campaign. So to some extent, the Obama campaign has defined Barack Obama's biography, as it were, through their campaign commercials. But where's the corporate media on this? They'd rather talk about, you know, is somebody having a secret meeting? Is there a secret meeting? You know, what's going on with the secret meeting? Or, you know, let's, you know, what does Pastor Hagee have to say about it this week? You know, I mean, we know the story of John McCain. We need to know the story of Barack Obama. Pro and con. Pro or con. People who are in favor of him, people who are opposed to him. Because if he is not defined, and I realize, as I said, he's trying to do that, but the corporate media is ignoring him. If he's not defined, McCain will do it for him.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
6 6 3 0 3 22 70 Anything goes Friday. Your calls 866-303-2270. Just a quick heads up here. The McCain campaign last month raised $21 million. The Republican National Committee raised $23.7 million. That's nearly $45 million last month raised by and large by fat cats for Republicans. And Barack Obama has announced he will not take money from PACs and lobbyists. So Democrats have their work cut out for them, I'm telling you. Jessica in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
Oh, wonderful. I just want to commend you on your book. I'm very interested. I must read it. I'm going to have to get a copy. I actually wanted to call because, you know, I notice you're always talking about how this all really started during the Reagan administration. And you're also, you state a lot about how our health is at risk, you know. And there are certain beliefs that were instigated during the Reagan administration that have been carried forward for the last 20, 25 years, and regarding health, they've become multi-billion dollar industries, and yet there are loads of scientists on several of these theories that have been calling to debate and rethink a lot of these beliefs that were sort of instigated during this sort of big money.
For example?
For example, HIV/AIDS, actually. During the Reagan administration, what I find really interesting is simultaneously we had the birth of biotech, which instigated the whole genetically modified thing. We had the gay pride movement. We had the birth of the drug war. And then we suddenly had HIV/AIDS, which came out after all of those target groups. And since, I would say, about 20 years now, there's been a group of almost 2,000 doctors, scientists from around the world, Australia, whatever, that have been calling out for a political debate, not really a political debate, but an open scientific debate to reappraise the HIV/AIDS hypothesis. All of these scientists have, you know, varying degrees of information, and I've actually sent you, Jeff, and Randy all a compilation of contacts that I have regarding this, because I would love to see you guys bring it up as a topic. There's actually enough contacts there that you guys could all cover it if you wanted to.
You know, I think it's broadly, Jessica, most of the folks who are suggesting that AIDS is not caused by the HIV virus, but instead is caused by you know, other variables or other factors
well,
can be cured
even
by wheatgrass juice.
Luc Montagnier, the French scientist who originally discovered HIV, and there was a whole big hoopla over Gallo and Lou, over who actually discovered it. Even he has come out in recent books that he's published, even though they're only in French right now.
Right.
Even he has come out stating that HIV alone cannot cause AIDS. And he's
that doesn't mean that he's not a crackpot.
Well, he's actually writing books on oxidative stress, which there's a German scientist also. But the thing is these are very accredited, and I have a...
Are you suggesting, Jessica, that there are cases out there of AIDS that are not associated with the HIV virus?
Oh, there are people who die of AIDS who do not have HIV.
Well, actually, I'll agree. There are a number of things that can compromise the immune system in ways that I suppose would look like AIDS. So this gets to the A equals B, therefore B equals C. So are you suggesting that if somebody is infected with the HIV virus and they don't have that very rare genetic immunity to it that seems to have come down from the Black Plague, the bubonic plague in Europe, if they don't have that genetic immunity to it, that HIV virus is not going to cause AIDS in them?
I've actually, as a researcher, I have worked with several people. As a matter of fact, there is a very strong belief that a large percentage of the actual AIDS deaths could be related to the pharmaceuticals. As a person who's worked
Why is it that in the 80s people got AIDS and they were dying, they were dropping like flies, and now people get AIDS and they use the pharmaceuticals and they live long and healthy lives?
Well, I've actually had mainstream researchers within the current hypothesis who agree that the drugs only work for 35% of their patients. And if you look very closely, that 35% of their patients generally have other diseases that are actually affected by the drugs. But if you don't happen to have these other virological problems, the drugs do harm. They do help certain people with Epstein-Barr, or other very interesting and hard-to-diagnose diseases.
Right.
There's actually about 80 different diseases that fall under the HIV-AIDS hypothesis and cross-react.
Yeah.
One of them happens to be pregnancy. But I know the people that tend to stay away from the drugs that don't have a horrible drug history. One of the things you were looking at during the 80s, okay, is that this disease was afflicting drug addicts, very sexually promiscuous people.
Well, it was afflicting people who were exchanging either blood or semen in blood. I mean,
exactly.
You know, and it still does. I mean, all over the world. And
exactly.
and the examples, in particularly in Africa, where you've had countries try abstinence-only programs where they weren't passing out condoms versus countries that were aggressively passing out condoms, there's a clear demonstration of the association between
well,
the two.
Africa is really interesting because I also lived in Africa for 3 years, and one of the things that made me question everything initially before I started taking it up from a serious research perspective was in Africa, you know, when you're seeing people that are malnourished and dying, first of all, let me make a point here. If you look at the ads for Feed Africa from the 70s and the early 80s, and you look at the ads for the supposed people dying of HIV/AIDS, the images are almost identical.
Well, it's because AIDS is a wasting disease. I mean,
well,
you end up burning off all your fats, and then you start burning off all your muscle
guess
tissue.
What else is a wasting disease, if you really want to get tricky? First of all, Third World Africa is not diagnosed by a blood test. Third World Africa is diagnosed by symptoms.
Right, but if people have food available to them, by and large, they're not going to end up with kwashiorkor. They're not going to end up with malnutrition diseases and protein deficiency
diseases. Well, pellagra, this is one of the interesting things that I also discovered in my research that you never hear mention of. Okay, pellagra is a wasting disease caused by a niacin deficiency,
right,
which is caused by corn subsistence.
Right, well, it's caused by a lack of variety in the diet so that you don't get the B vitamins necessary.
Most of Third World Africa lives on cornmeal. Remember, I live there. I've noticed their diet very distinctly. They
corn was not indigenous to Africa. Corn came from North America.
Corn came from us feeding them corn because they're starving. So they're starving, and we're feeding them a nutritionally deficient food, which causes wasting.
Jessica, I've worked in Africa for on and off for over 20 years. I don't think I've ever seen anybody delivering corn. It's always been rice.
Rice. Well, in South Africa, where it is claimed to be most prevalent,
okay.
I've lived in a hut without running water and electricity with several of the tribes
I haven't been there. I've been in East Africa, Central Africa, and North Africa. Jessica, I've got to move along, but thank you for raising the topic. I think it's fascinating. We'll just leave it at that. You suggested we should do a show on it sometime. I think we just did. Evan, in Research Triangle, what's the state there?
Park.
Research Triangle Park.
Yes.
And still, what state is that? I'm
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Okay, great. Hey, Evan, what's up?
Well, my question is, if we can put all sorts of pollution on Mars, and we have this sort of technology and this know-how, why can't we construct an engine that runs on sunlight, CO2, with a waste product of oxygen, which is what plants have been doing for the past 3 billion years?
Right, photosynthesis.
And that the average tree is a heck of a lot more complex than the average car.
Yeah, you're right. And it's a fascinating area of inquiry. Right now we're focusing on converting sunlight into electricity. Plants, by and large, convert sunlight into biomass. Some of that biomass is starches and sugars. A lot of it is cellulose.
With a product of oxygen.
Right, exactly. And so if we were to simply try to recreate photosynthesis and use chlorophyll as this, or some analog of chlorophyll, even some artificially created chlorophyll, we would be converting water and carbon dioxide into cellulose. Which may have some value. I mean, you could produce something that could then be reburned. It would be a way of storing sunlight, basically, which is what trees
right.
do. But I think the broad consensus is converting it to electricity, you get a much higher efficiency, a much higher ratio. But it's an interesting concept, the idea of replicating biology. Evan, thanks a lot for the call. Lots of scratching your head, how can we do this? That would be a good one. That would be a really good one that I suspect we're going to be seeing coming down the road. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio, 866-303-2270, or telephone number tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. And some of the stranger topics for the day, too. This is our anything, everything you know is wrong day, it seems. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Prison's gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. Working your fingers bare to the bone. Breaking your back, make you sell your soul. Like a lung that's filled with cold. Suffocating slow. The wind blows wild and I may move. But politicians lie and I am not fooled. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth. The air on my skin and the world under my
30,
clothes.
Excuse me, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman Program, $58,000 a year. Now, if somebody came to you and said, well, actually, instead of just setting that all up in that context, let me just lay this right out. John McCain, who voted against the GI Bill of Rights, has been classified by the Veterans Administration by the U.S. military as 100% disabled. And for that, he brings in $58,000 a year tax-free. For somebody in his income bracket, that's, over $100,000 a year pre-taxes. That he gets in exchange for being 100% disabled. And yet his wife is worth $100 million. He makes a couple hundred thousand dollars a year as a United States senator, and he's telling us that he's not so disabled that he can be president of the United States. Can you imagine if Barack Obama was pulling a 100% disability from any U.S. federal agency for any purpose, was claiming 100% disability and being paid $58,000 a year, what the Republicans would do with that? I mean, just consider it for a moment. Matt in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was going to ask you your opinion on a Ron Paul Obama ticket.
I think it'd be a disaster.
You think it'd be a disaster?
Yeah. Ron Paul's a libertarian, and Barack Obama is a liberal. And in as much as the cons are right in characterizing him as such. And, I don't see where the two – I mean – What part of Ron Paul do you think would be, why do you think he would be a good VP?
Well, I think that he has good name recognition. He has a very strong following, and I think he'd take a lot of votes away from McCain.
I think he's going to take a lot of votes away from McCain anyway, or the Libertarian candidate, actually. It's going to be Bob Barr, but I think the Libertarians are going to take a big bite out of McCain's pant leg or whatever. But, Ron Paul would, if he had the ability, if Ron Paul was president, he would do away with the Social Security Administration. He wouldn't just cut your Social Security benefits. He'd cut them off altogether. He would do away with federal aid to education. He'd do away with federal aid to highways and infrastructure. He would privatize the national air traffic control system. He would be in favor of more private contractors doing more and more of our military functions. I mean, it's just... libertarian philosophy is nuts. There is no country in the history of the world that has functioned using a libertarian economic model. None. I mean, it's really nice to hear, Ron Paul and libertarians talk about, they're all in favor of decriminalizing consensual sex between consenting adults, decriminalizing prostitution by and large, or making, decriminalizing pot or even all drugs. I mean, the libertarian points of view makes them sound like maybe they're liberals. But no, they're not liberals. What they're saying is that the federal government, in their language, has no business in our affairs, and as if the federal government is some separate entity. We don't live in the days of kings any longer. I mean, George Bush has been trying to create it that way, but we really don't. This is a small d democracy, or a democratic republic, a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, which means the government is us. And if we collectively get together and say, we really want to take care of us. We want to make sure that we collectively have access to health care. We think that that's a right. We think that there should be a public school system. Ron Paul would do away with all federal funding for public schools and for education. So if you happen to be born in West Virginia, you're not going to get one-third the quality of education that if you happen to be born in California you would get. It is, I mean, I just can't imagine why anybody would say that Ron Paul and the libertarian policies are rational, much less sufficiently rational to be Obama's VP.
Well, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't want him to be president, but I'm just thinking the best way to get Obama the presidency and
I understand the appeal. Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. I understand the appeal of kind of reaching out to the other side and bringing them in. And Ron Paul, it's amazing. Ron Paul's followers, I mean, they're almost cult-like. When I was in New Hampshire during the primary there, we were doing our show from the Radio Row there. I was just amazed at the candidate who had the most people in the streets continuously, everywhere you went, all the demonstrations, it was Ron Paul. And there's a lot of young people who don't understand the consequences of libertarian politics, maybe their parents have been supporting them, who don't realize that the free public education they got is something that Ron Paul would do away with, who don't understand that colleges around the United States exist in large part because of state and federal aid, at least in a reasonable price, and that if Ron Paul had his way, they wouldn't be able to go to college. A lot of young people just don't get it, frankly, because they never apparently had civics classes or government courses, and so they're easy pickings for the crazies on the right. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, you got a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I heard you and Bernie talking about creating a solar creating a better world through solar electricity.
Yeah.
And I have an idea to promote solar energy, clean, renewable solar energy, and it's called the Clean Energy Combo. And the Clean Energy Combo is one or more electric vehicles in combination with a solar electric rooftop. all the tax incentive and rebate programs are bundled into one easy to understand signable contract.
Mm-hmm.
And right there you've become green. You've reduced your carbon footprint for your house and your car. And also it turns out that the payback on a solar electric rooftop is about 8 to 10 years. But when you use it to pump sunlight, when you use it instead of liquid fuels, the payback is reduced to about 5 years, and then you get another, because solar electric rooftops are warrantied for about 25 years, you get another
and they have,
years of free electricity.
Right, exactly. And they have a real lifetime of probably around 50 years is the best estimate right now. Good point, Harvey. Packaging and marketing is necessary. Newt Gingrich knew this. He got 6 out of the 10 points in his contract on America. They pointed back to legislation that was tax cuts for people who made more than $200,000 a year. 6 out of 10 of the contract on America was tax cuts for wealthy people. Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Your radio support group for We the People. To the Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Anything Goes Friday. Your topics, Lenora in Portland, Maine. Hey, Lenora, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, they've been running these ads in Maine, and they're, quote, from the Center for Union Facts. And they're really anti-union ads, and they're talking about how big union is trying to hurt the workers, and they have all these people, you know, spouting all these lies. And
yep.
So what I did a little research, and I found out that the ads are from Rick Brennerman, who, you know, is a lobbyist for anti-union groups.
Yeah, especially the National Association of Manufacturers and the National Chambers of Commerce. This is what's amazing to me. What these guys are getting ready for is, if there's a Democratic president, if Barack Obama is president and there's a Democratic House and Senate, there will be card check legislation. It's going to be one of the very first things on the table to pass. That is legislation that makes it easier for people to form a union in the workplace and harder for an employer to bust a union or prevent a union from forming. This is a $3 billion a year industry right now, just the industry of being consultants to big corporations or even medium and small sized corporations, helping them stop there being a union in their workplace. While ever since 1935, we've had laws on the books that guarantee the right to unionization. They've been diluted. They were diluted in 47, and they've been diluted, you know, a number of times since then. And then when Reagan came in, essentially turned the Department of Labor, whose mandate was to enforce these laws, the Wagner Act of 35, the National Labor Relations Act, and so on. I mean, and even when Taft-Hartley in 47 cut back on the rights of labor, as it were, and their efforts since then, still, you know, the Labor Department is supposed to be defending the interests of labor. Clinton returned it to that purpose, but with the sole exception of the 8 years of the Clinton administration, the Department of Labor for 30 years now has been basically the Department of Big Corporate business, you know, pushing back on labor. And this Union Facts group, and there's another one, we've seen the ads in Oregon as well. They look like they're local ads. They look like they're local groups. They bought full page ads in the newspaper. They're laying the groundwork right now. They're fighting the battle right now in advance, and the unions are going to get into the act probably after the election. And I have a feeling that a lot of damage is going to be done. A lot of minds are going to be captured between now and then with this false dog and pony show that they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what makes me so mad, because they make it look like it's just a regular, you know, a real group of concerned people.
And we're real union workers, and we're, you know, and we're concerned about, absolutely. We don't want to be pushed around by the big bosses. Lenora, this is the opening salvo. This is big business trying to cover their butts and make sure that their CEOs still can be paid $300-400 million, $500 million a year, and that they can do that by paying their employees lousy wages. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what it's all about. Thanks a lot for the call and for pointing it out. Tim in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is Anything Goes Friday, right?
Yeah.
All right. There's a Captain Eric May, M-A-Y, retired military intelligence officer who, with some colleagues, is trying to bring to the public's awareness the false flag concept. Now, a false flag is where, say, country A wants to invade country B, but there's no provocation. So country A creates an incident on itself, blames it on country B, and thusly has the impetus to invade country B.
Right. We explored that here in the United States with regard to Cuba, having a jetliner portrayed as a Cuban plane, doing harm. I mean, there were actually several different variations on those things.
Yeah.
You could argue that the Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag operation.
Exactly, exactly.
You could argue that the USS
Pearl Harbor.
Well, that's pretty debatable, but the USS Maine looks like the boiler blew up. It's who knows. But, yeah, so
yeah.
To bring this to today.
So to today, the reason I called was because this last Tuesday, out of the blue, you read a news clip in regards to military personnel converging on Indianapolis.
Yeah.
This month.
Yeah, there were actually two or three of those that I read back to back, and they were all basically military exercises going on in the United States in high population areas not all of them were high population, but several of them were. And I was just raising the question, are we being, in fact, interestingly, last night, went to dinner with a couple of friends of mine, Jerry and Elizabeth, and Elizabeth made the comment, there was all these helicopters, because this guy was climbing the New York Times building, and all these helicopters were in the air, and the police cars were running up 8th Avenue with their sirens blaring, because this was just like 10 blocks north of us. And Elizabeth said, every day there's like a terrorist drill here in Manhattan where 40 police cars will just go blurring, blazing down the street. And she said, when it first started happening, it freaked us all out. But now we're all used to this huge kind of semi-quasi-military presence here in the city.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, they're getting us used to it. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. And May's feeling is that the MO for the administration to pull something is going to be a military exercise like you're describing that's going to take place in Indianapolis to be there to clean up the aftermath of a nuclear explosion.
Sort of like at the very time of 9/11, they were doing drills
exactly.
On what would happen if something like 9/11 were to happen?
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
he's
very suspicious in regards to them setting off a nuclear device and then having the personnel there to take care of the aftermath.
Yeah, that's Tim. I sure hope that you're wrong. I know.
I do too.
Yeah, I know that we.
But
both.
I don't trust these guys beyond as far as I could throw.
No, I don't either. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. In fact, the scenario that I could see playing out with a lot of plausibility is George Bush bombs Iran, bombs a nuclear reactor there, and the next day or a couple days later, some terrible thing happens in the United States. Your scenario of a nuclear or a dirty nuclear device going off at some city or something like that. Something terrible happens in the United States, which may or may not be the result of an Iranian group or an Iranian connected group or Al-Qaeda, which, by the way, is not Iran. In fact, Al-Qaeda is the Sunnis and Iran is the Shia. And then that becomes the basis for this continuity of government being invoked. And all of a sudden, we don't have any constitutional rights anymore. We don't have any government anymore. And George Bush is emperor. And then we have to ask ourselves, how do we push back on that? And I'm telling you, I don't think the way to push back on that, this is where I disagree with the people on the far right who from time to time have me on their radio programs, is I don't think the way to push back is to take your guns out in the street. But I do think a way to push back is to do what Mahatma Gandhi did, and that is to go out on the streets. I've talked about this before. What if everybody walked into the crosswalks of every street near them, when the light was green, safely walked in the crosswalk and then just laid down and said, we're shutting the city down. We're shutting the country down. You know, we want America back. Now, that's assuming that they take it away from us in a full-blown, full-bore, basically kind of military coup attempt like that. So we'll see. Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Howard.
Yes. Let me shake my arm. My arm went to sleep.
I'm sorry. I know you've been on hold for about
an hour. No, that's fine. That's no problem at all. I wanted to talk to Bernie, and I think that you yourself and Bernie should make your listeners aware that there is a conservative wing of the Democrat Party.
It's the Democratic Party. I know Chris Matthews yesterday referred to it as the Democrat Party twice. It's the Democratic Party. There is no such thing as a Democrat Party.
Right. They are Democrats. They are Democrats. But I really feel that Nancy Pelosi, you know, they have what is called the Black Caucus. And they are Black Democrats who meet and talk about issues pertaining to, you know, Black Americans.
Right.
And which is
there's a Hispanic caucus. There's the you're talking about the Yellow Dogs and the Blue Dogs and all this kind of thing. Is that where you're going with all this?
What I think Nancy Pelosi should do is try to put together a group so that the conservative Democrats could sit down and talk with the other wing of the Democrat Party, the more central
Democratic
liberal,
Party,
and so that they could meet with each other and discuss issues to help the Democrat Party.
Yeah, the Democratic Party, Howard, and they have that. It's called the Democratic Caucus, and the Democrats do meet and they do discuss these things. And the Progressive Caucus and the Blue Dog Caucus and but the larger point, and I think it's a serious and important one to make, is that Nancy Pelosi has a majority in the House of some 30-odd votes, but she's got more than 40 representatives, Democrats, who represent largely conservative districts. And frankly, I'm of the opinion that's why impeachment hasn't happened. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Your radio support group for We the People.
Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. 21 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here. Art in Seattle, Washington. You've been on hold for a while, Art. My thanks for sticking around. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Can I share with you the information that I just gave a representative for David Plouffe? He's the campaign manager for Obama for America.
Okay.
I've just been solicited for another $100. I just gave $100 about 2 days ago, and the message from David Plouffe was, quote, here's a shorty. I'm sure that you've heard that Hillary Clinton is suspending her campaign. We all owe Senator Clinton and her supporters a great deal of respect. Okay? My concern is, and this is what I said to Plouffe's representative, is that I'm a pensioner, and if I give $100, and if 100,000 other American citizens also give $100 each, this will retire Hillary Clinton's campaign debt to herself. Another 100,000 of us giving $100 each will retire the other $10 million that Hillary Clinton's subscribers have pledged to her and she owes. What I'm saying now is that I am not willing that my 100 now and the hundreds that I've given in the past several months should be given to retire the campaign debt for Hillary Clinton. Because as far as I'm concerned, if that's what she talked about last night when she met with Barack Obama and Senator Feinstein, if that's what her condition was for instead of suspending her campaign, but giving up her campaign and giving her support to the duly appointed or the duly voted
elected
representative.
Is the word.
I beg your pardon?
Elected.
Elected.
Just like the President of the United States is elected via the Electoral College, the Democratic and the Republican nominees are
right.
elected via the electors that we are referred to as delegates.
Perfect, Tom. What I'm saying, I'm not going to repeat myself,
yeah.
is that this is what I consider, if this is her condition,
so are you
which I don't know, that is called, in my book, that's called blackmail, and I will not be a party to that. As far as I'm concerned, if the Democratic Party as a whole wishes to retire that $20 million campaign debt that Hillary Clinton has accumulated in attacking Barack Obama, then that's okay. But I don't want my money to be that was given to the Obama campaign to be given to
right.
Hillary Clinton to retire her campaign debt.
Yeah, I get it, Art. I don't. My personal take on this is that if the Obama, you know, it's a tough one. On the one hand, money is going to be a really important thing. While Obama has demonstrated his ability to raise money is startling. Nonetheless, you know, John McCain raised over $40 million last month between his campaign and the RNC. They've got some very fat cats with some very deep pockets, and there's a whole lot more to come. I mean, it hasn't even begun. Not to mention the 527s and all these other groups that are going to be coming out of the woodwork that are going to be driving this campaign. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton's participation in this campaign, you could say, you know, well, she was using that money to attack Barack Obama. Another way to frame that, to perceive that, to view that, would be to say that, you know, her staying in the campaign was getting more and more Democrats active, was bringing more and more attention to the campaign, was putting more of the spotlight on both Obama and Clinton, that I think it was a net positive. And so should Democrats say, okay, you did a good job, you did a net positive. Yeah, there were a few things in there that may have hurt the guy that ended up being our candidate long term. You know, there's probably a few Hillary Clinton sound bites that are going to be part of the Republican attack ads. But, you know, that happens in any primary. The Democrats, if they had wanted to attack Ronald Reagan, could have used George Herbert Walker Bush talking about voodoo economics in their ads. They chose not to. They should have. But in any case, you know, that's life in the big city. But, you know, we're all Democrats now. We're all in this together. So I'm sorry. I think that whether it's Obama partisans still trying to fight against Hillary Clinton, as I would characterize your comments, Art, or whether it's Clinton partisans still trying to trash Barack Obama, and I'm getting those emails every day, it's time for it to stop. You know, on both sides, and to say, we need to pull this thing together. Robin in Wisconsin. Hey, Robin, we've got about a minute before the break. What's up? Robin?
I've got a friend that he's a sportsman like myself, and he's always voted Republican because he was worried that the Democrats were going to steal your guns.
Right.
And I finally converted him. I took him online. And I showed him Presidential Directive number 51 and looked at him and I said, okay, now what happens if we go into martial law? What's the first thing they're going to do? He said, they're going to come and take our guns. I said, exactly. And you've never seen a Democrat say that they were ever going to do anything like that.
Now, this was the Bush
administration. But this guy is saying that if there's a natural disaster, he might come and do it.
That's right. That's right. Robin, excellent point. Excellent point. Thank you very much. Yeah, if you want to be worried about the government coming to take your guns, then you don't want to be electing a Republican. Real simple. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The hour, 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Lock me in Oakland, California. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well. Are you the Lock Me I met at the event that we had there in San Francisco?
Yes, it is. It was so great chatting with you.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say about Barack Obama, number one, that he is showing up already the day after he was nominated as a leader by having the DNC refuse to take lobbyist money and PAC money, just like he's refusing to do. That's one thing. The second thing, in an interview yesterday with Candy Crowley, he said, look, you know, when the next time you'll hear from me about who my vice president will be is when I've made my decision.
Right.
So he's not going to be pushed around.
You're right. He's taking an assertive position. He is demonstrating, I think, and thank you, Lockme, for the call. I think he's demonstrating that as president, he's not going to be anybody who's going to be, you know, he's not like George W. Bush, and his vice president is going to say, no, George, this is the way it is. Or for that matter, he's not going to be like Bill Clinton, who was sat down by Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, and they said, well, Bill, we know you campaigned on this very progressive platform, but it's not going to be how you're going to govern. No, he's going to be his own man. Nora in Minneapolis. Hey, Nora.
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm so grateful that you have Anything Goes. I hope it's really true, because I have four major issues, and this one that I want to bring up today, they're all extremely disturbing for people to talk about and hear about. But what I want to remind people, now that I'm faced with the headline in Star Tribune that says Franken-Pornorama, not satirist, it brings up this whole issue that I want to remind people how Norm Coleman got elected in a place like Minnesota.
Yeah, to take the seat of...
Say what?
Yeah, continue.
A beloved senator from Minnesota, Paul Wellstone, got crashed in an airplane less than 2 weeks before his reelection.
Yeah, and about that same time, the same thing was happening in Missouri. And John Ashcroft could not beat a dead guy there.
I believe it was the 2 years earlier was the second time that I had to see the attempt to win over a Democratic incumbent senator, and yet he didn't win anyway. But the first time is all about, to me, the Leonard Peltier case, William Janklow. It's all connected up with that because he was the first time that I watched this, William Janklow running against Mickelson, the incumbent senator of Democratic of South Dakota. It was approximately 8 to 10 years before Ashcroft's non-victory, and he did win when the incumbent Democratic senator was crashed down in the airplane less than 2 weeks. But also, William Janklow, in the beginning, when he first ran for office in 1974 for statewide office as Attorney General, he had the motto that said, the only way to deal with the Indian problem in South Dakota is to put a gun to the AIM leaders' heads and pull the trigger. And that's how he first won Attorney General, and then he became governor later, and then when he ran against George Mickelson, etc. And how he ended his Senate career was by running a stop sign and killing a motorcyclist in Minnesota.
Nora, are you suggesting that... political assassination is...
natural coincidences that can...
Well, you know, the reality is that politicians fly around a lot in small airplanes. And I can tell you, as a private pilot, as a pilot of a small airplane, actually I haven't flown in probably 15 years now. And one of the reasons why I don't fly anymore, aside from the fact that I have no time, is that my life insurance, your life insurance just spikes. You know, it's although there are companies that specialize in it, but the fact of the matter is
it's really dangerous. Right?
Yeah, well, it's not probably as dangerous as bungee jumping, but it's, you know, it's or but you know, things happen. You know, yeah.
I forgot one more detail that was very interesting. Ted Kennedy was supposed to be in
he was supposed to,
with Paul Wellstone until 1 hour before he canceled. He was good.
Yeah, and that would have flipped the balance of power in the Senate. And I understand those conspiracy theories. And I remember when I was training to be a pilot, my flight instructor, who used to love to, you know, try to disorient his students. You know, he'd take us up to 6,000 feet, put the hood on, we're flying on instruments only, and all of a sudden, my compass and my gyro and the magnetic compass aren't making sense with each other, for example, because he's taken a little refrigerator magnet and stuck it up underneath the dash of the airplane, and it's disorienting one of the instruments. So, you know, I don't know if anybody ever looked through the wreckage of those planes in Missouri and Wisconsin for little refrigerator magnets, but it's an old trick that most pilots can tell you about. I don't know. I'm not ready to go there, but I understand why a lot of people are scratching their heads. I think the important thing is to talk about not the fact that Norm Coleman has basically been George Bush Light, just like Gordon Smith in the state of Oregon has been George Bush Light. And both these guys are employing the same identical strategy, which is a year before the election, all of a sudden start criticizing their own party and in some small ways vote against their party and then run as a moderate and certainly get the cooperation of the corporate media to call them a moderate when they're not. Jimmy, and thanks for the call. Jimmy in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
My question is about Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I listen to the radio, I listen to these right-wingers, you know, like Rush and Sean Hannity. My question is, what was it about Ronald Reagan that he became the pinnacle of conservatism? And how did he, during his presidency, how did he fund the country at the end of his presidency? How did he leave the country as far as, you know, the economically wise and any other ways that you can actually pinpoint if he did a good job or not?
Well, if you get it that the conservative agenda is starting before Reagan and continuing through Reagan and even to this day, primarily the conservative agenda is twofold. Number one, to concentrate wealth and power in a small number of hands. And Jimmy, thank you for raising the topic. To concentrate wealth and power in a small number of hands because conservatives basically don't believe in the small-d democratic process. They don't believe that democracies will last, frankly. They believe, as Thomas Hobbes wrote back in the 1630s, 1635 in Leviathan, that without the iron fist of church or state, that the life of man will be nasty, shortish, brutish, and short, that there'd be no art, no letters, et cetera, et cetera. They believe, as John Adams did, the first conservative president of the United States, that if you let the rabble govern, that the government will disintegrate and the country will fall into chaos. They genuinely believe this. And so there has to be a ruling aristocracy in the conservative worldview. And the natural Darwinian process in their minds is that those who are the wealthiest, obviously, are the most fit to rule. And so money equals power equals stability, because conservatives, keep in mind, conservatives value, this is, you know, fundamental, conservatives 101. I mean, you read The Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk. He wrote it in 1953. It was the book that kicked off the modern conservative movement. It was the book that got William F. Buckley going. It was the book that changed Barry Goldwater's life. It's still in print. It's still quoted. And he opens it by talking, the opening chapter is titled Sir Edmund Burke, who in the 1790s had a verbal fist fight that lasted for several weeks with Thomas Paine, who stayed at Burke's house while he was on his way to France to the French Revolution. And Paine was so upset about that verbal confrontation that they had that he wrote an entire book to rebut Burke's thinking, that book called The Rights of Man, in which Paine, you know, laid out essentially a proposal for a Social Security program and for unemployment programs. And it was really quite remarkable. But nonetheless, Burke said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to participate, to have a profession such as tallow maker, candle maker, or hairdresser. It does me no harm. But it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in governance, either by running for office or by voting. Now, the last part I added, but that was the context. So Burke was saying that only the elite should be allowed to vote, because only the elite are really smart enough to rule. And the way you define elite is by wealth.
And that's what modern conservatives believe as well. So when Reagan came to office, the top tax rate for the wealthiest Americans, if you made over $3 million a year income, over $3 million a year in today's dollars, then every penny after that $3 million was taxed at a 71% tax rate. That was what Kennedy left it at. And Kennedy closed most of the loopholes. He actually raised taxes on the rich. Even though the top rate was 91%, there were a million loopholes in there that had come in during the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy got rid of those things and at the same time dropped it from 91 down to 71%. So 71%. Reagan dropped that down to 25%. I think it even might have gone down to 24%. I believe it was 27% at the end of his presidency. I don't have the numbers. But in any case, below 30%. And it was just, you know, paradise. And now you've got a situation where not only that, but if you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, if the principal source of your income is dividends or interest, like George Bush being born with a huge trust fund where his main, you know, one of his main sources of income is interest on bonds and the stock market, then you pay a maximum 15%. So of course they're going to deify Reagan. He concentrated wealth and power in the United States.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green. Red roses too, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer, Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, and Andrew Dunn at Air America. Thanks, guys. To Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. 866-303-2270, Margot in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Margot.
Tom, thanks for your wonderful program. I'll be quick. Most of my acquaintances and neighbors think that universal health care is socialized medicine. They don't know there's a difference with single-payer nonprofit.
Right, and thus, for example, the unfortunate editorial in, was it the New York Times, the New York Post? There was a big deal being made out of it day before yesterday here in New York about how Ted Kennedy would have gotten very different to health care had he been in England, where they have socialized medicine.
I think progressives and Democrats need to show the difference over and over again. The message is not getting out there.
Yeah.
And but anyway, thanks. I hope you keep informing the public.
Thanks. I will.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Margot. And the point is that, yes, the fact of the matter is that Ted Kennedy got faster and better health care than the average person in England would get. Sure. And in fact, in England, where they have socialized medicine, and it's one of the poorer of the national health care systems, in my opinion, among all of the industrialized nations. But nonetheless, in England, you know, the average person would not get quite as fast and quite as good a health care as Ted Kennedy got. But in England, you can, I believe, you can buy private health insurance, and there are private health insurers. It's not illegal. So if Ted Kennedy was Ted Kennedy in the United Kingdom, he would have gotten the same health care coverage that he got here in the United States. Now, the problem is bringing up Ted Kennedy, because the question shouldn't be, what kind of health care will the Ted Kennedys of the world have? Because the fact of the matter is, the Ted Kennedys of the world, whether it's the millionaires in Hong Kong or the millionaires in Dubai or the millionaires in England or the millionaires in Massachusetts, the millionaires are going to get the very best health care money can buy, period, by any definition. You know, welcome to the world. The question is, would the average Joe in Massachusetts who has a glioma get the same health care as the average Joe in the UK, particularly if the average Joe happens not to have a job or is working at Walmart or at Kmart and has no health insurance? And the answer is no. There would be a huge difference between the United States and the UK. And that said, the health care in the United Kingdom is largely, it's not truly socialized medicine, but it's closer to socialized medicine than single-payer healthcare systems like they have in Germany, in as much as the government actually owns most of the hospitals, most of the doctors and most of the local clinics, and most of the doctors are actually employees of the government. So the UK system is more like the system that we have for our veterans, the Veterans Administration hospital system. It's owned by the government. The doctors are employees of the government. On the other hand, a single-payer healthcare system is more like Medicare. See, we have both in the United States. We do have socialized medicine in the United States. It's called the VA. And we do have single-payer, and it's called Medicare. And with the single-payer system, the government simply writes the check. You go to any doctor you want. You can go to any hospital you want. They compete with each other for your business, and the government writes the check. And that's how it works in most of the countries, or variations on that in most of the countries of the world, most of the industrialized countries of the world that actually have decent health care. John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I want to give a little experience from my mother's point of view. She was raised in occupied Denmark in World War II. Mm-hmm. And Denmark was a unique country in that it was one of the only ones allowed to operate its own police force and infrastructure throughout the most of the war when the Nazis were occupying their country.
Didn't France do that? Wasn't that the whole Vichy French thing?
Well, that was a little different. They didn't. Vichy actually was a cooperating government with.
I see. So Denmark did this was allowed to do this as a non-cooperating government.
Yeah. It was slightly different in that. They trusted the Danes to operate the country because they were busy trying to seduce the Danes and
right.
as many as possible into their military system.
Okay, so to your mom's experience.
Well, her mother and her uncle were both in the resistance, and my mother was an unwitting courier for the resistance. And what happened in their country and with them was that they, when there was a problem in 1943 when they finally gave up the country as a whole, they went through a general strike in August of 1943 and stopped cooperating with the Germans. And the Germans got fed up and a year later really started cracking down on the Danes. Mm-hmm. But they did not cooperate with them, and they also did stuff like when there was a pursuit of someone who was resisting against the rule, the German occupation, they would come out on their bicycles, much the way we do a critical mass once a month around here for 3 hours a night.
Mm-hmm.
But they would come out on their bicycles and ring their bells in unison and block the traffic of the pursuit. And there's a good example. You can watch the film called The Counterfeit Traitor with William Holden.
Right. So this is apropos of my comment earlier that if
what we do is
yeah, that if Bush strike. Tries to impose martial law in the United States, that we should have a general strike.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes on in a lot of the other European countries. France, for example, is pretty good at it. And
yeah.
When I was there one time when they had a
although Sarkozy is doing his best to bust the unions in France right now. And he's having some significant successes.
Yeah,
and
true.
The Financial Times has been, you know, running articles, essentially bragging about it. You know, it's so weird because Europe is moving in the direction of Reaganism, and we're moving, I think, away from it. But John, thanks for the call. We're out of time, but excellent, excellent story. I do agree. That's the way to go. Coming up Monday, I'll be debating Frank Gaffney, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy, about whether or not suspects found guilty of terrorist crimes against the United States deserve the death penalty. Plus, Rich Trumka, the AFL-CIO, is going to talk about John McCain. Best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.